Welcome to the Ex-Millennial Man Podcast, the podcast for SeedSing.com. I am your host, R.D. Kulik. And with me is, well, I guess, are we both the bald one and the fat one? I thought one of us, well, you're the tall one, so you'd be the Siskel to my Ebert. That's the greatest other host, Ty Kulik. How are you today, Ty?
Hi, everybody. I also think I'm fatter than you, too, if we're going with that, based on just body size.
I've been getting slim.
You're slimming down. I still run all the time.
Some mass. I'm cultivating mass. That's Mac.
You and Mac, that's what you guys are doing. You're cultivating mass. No, man, you told me what we were going to talk about today, and these are two dudes that I watched on TV all the time, probably when you and I lived together. I remember being so upset when they were gone and Ignaty Vishkovetsky took over.
Oh, I will be discussing Ignaty and his glorious reign, and it is going to be awesome. We are talking about Siskel and Ebert. This came about because just recently an author, I have his book now that you guys can see it, but Matt Sainer, who's a New York film critic, he writes for, I think, Screen Rant, maybe?
He was just on
Screen Crush. He writes for Screen Crush.
He was just on an episode of Doughboys that I listened to like maybe a couple weeks ago. But yeah, he was recently on that, talking about that book you just...
Yeah, the book's called Opposable Thumbs, A History of How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. I've always been a big Siskel and Ebert fan. I've always been a fan, and I'm going to talk a lot in this podcast about how their show in particular probably made me not just the fan I am, but also gave me some of my arrogance, let's say, about film, because I think Siskel and Ebert taught an entire generation, and I'm talking about Generation X and the Millennials, two generations, about movies. And in a lot of ways, we're going to talk about a particular film that I think even the director of the movie says that this movie would have never, ever been successful if it wasn't for Siskel and Ebert. That's how influential they were.
I used to look forward. I would look forward to their TV show. Just as you said, it's kind of like if I want to see a movie, I'm going to see it. But I knew watching the two of them talk about it, if one of them liked it, I was pretty much like, I thought, OK, I'm going to enjoy this, too. And they had the best rating system. It wasn't out of stars. It wasn't out of 10. It was either thumbs up or thumbs down. The easiest way you could have done something.
Yeah, absolutely the easiest way. I would even say I'm going to talk a little bit about their influence at the end here, but even how Rotten Tomatoes, it's not 50% of critics here fresh. It's 60%. Mm-hmm. And then to be like certified fresh, I think has to be over 75% or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
I'm going to talk about these two men, and I'm going to talk about their shows a little bit, give you like how they influenced me, talk about how they influenced you, and even play a couple of interesting little clips. And I tried to find some more deeper cuts. I'm not going to play the hits, so to say, but I'll talk about the hits. I'll tell people that.
Sure.
But let's start with Roger Ebert, because the show is called Siskel and Ebert, but Roger Ebert was born first.
Okay.
He was born in 1942, went to the University of Illinois. Fresh out of college, he studied, I think, literature or writing or something. But fresh out of college, he started to do some writing. He wrote a book on like the history of the University of Illinois or something.
Oh, okay. And
he would teach some classes at the University of Chicago, and he started to write about film. And he thought, you know what? I'll do this for 5 years and move on to the next thing. And he became the head film critic at the Chicago Sun-Times. He is also the very first film critic in history to win the Pulitzer Prize for criticism.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he won that in 1975. But Roger Ebert wasn't just about film criticism. Roger Ebert loved the movies. And as a matter of fact, he has a screenplay, a movie that he wrote, a very famous movie. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I believe it's called Valley of the Dolls.
No, it's Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Okay, I haven't seen it, but living with you and growing up with you, you talked about it quite a bit.
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls was a movie that was kind of hated in its time. You said Valley of the Dolls, a famous movie about young women and drug abuse and all this other stuff. Well, they decided Roger Ebert was asked by a friend of his, filmmaker Russ Meyer. Now, do you know anything about Russ Meyer movies?
Nope.
There's a Seinfeld, the one with Terry Hatcher, who has the...
They're real and spectacular, yeah.
And Elaine's describing her at one time as being very chesty, and she's like, it's like a Russ Meyer movie. That's what Russ Meyer was known for, is they called them sexploitation films. They weren't pornography, but they had women acting crazy who usually were very well endowed in the chest area.
Would it be, is it like Skinamax?
Yeah, it's more comedy, though. Or okay. Satire. I don't want to say comedy, more satire. Roger Ebert wrote this movie, and he, to this day, still very, very proud, till he's passed away, but yeah. Was very, very proud of it his entire life, never shied from it. As a matter of fact, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls has become kind of this cult classic. A lot of people have looked back on it and said, oh, this is a good movie. But
okay.
That's the only film credit that Roger Ebert has.
Okay.
Shortly after Roger Ebert became the film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, Gene Siskel, who was also from Chicago, but he went to Yale. He actually has his degree in philosophy from Yale.
Dope.
He came back and would work for the Chicago Tribune. A lot of people probably don't know this or whatever, but the Chicago Tribune was the real paper, was the paper of record, so to say. It was the serious one. And the Sun-Times was considered kind of like a rag, a kind of a tabloid paper, like the New York Times compared to the New York Post, even though I think they're both trash, but that's the best way to explain it.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I actually learned this by reading Singer's book. The call letters for WGN, the cable channel, is actually because the Tribune owned it. The WGN stands for World's Greatest News, because that was the tagline of the Chicago Tribune. So Gene Siskel, he is in Chicago and he is writing film criticism for the quote unquote more respectable paper, even though Roger Ebert has a Pulitzer Prize. Well, Roger Ebert had been teaching some classes on film or like film history, and the local PBS station decided, you know what, they have a couple like political shows where different people talk. They're like, well, maybe Roger Ebert can come and talk about film. And then we'll invite another film critic to talk with them, and it will be like a debate show, but about movies. So, Ty, a show you've never heard of in your entire life was born, called Opening Soon at a Theater Near You.
Yeah, never heard of that. I don't know what that is.
Now, I'm going to play for you the very first, and again, this is PBS. This show premiered, I believe it was November of 1975. Yeah, it was November 26, 1975. When Opening Soon at a Theater Near You. As a matter of fact, I'm going to talk later on about Roger and Ebert on David Letterman. The first Letterman show they ever went on, Roger
Siskel
Ebert,
and Ebert. Or you Siskel said Roger and Ebert.
Yeah,
Ebert.
Sorry, Siskel and Ebert. The first Letterman they ever went on, Roger Ebert says that the show was over by the time they got the title out, because it was just a kind of a word salad. But I'm going to play for you, Ty. This is the very first movie that they're reviewing. It's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I want you to listen to this, and then I'm going to discuss what we think about it afterwards.
Okay.
The festival had the world premiere last week of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which just had the audience tearing up the seats with joy.
Yeah, and also, I think tearing up a little my enjoyment of the film. They were applauding even during the credits as Jack Nicholson's name came on the screen for the credits. The place went wild. Same thing for the director, Milos Forman.
They even applauded the cinematographer.
Yeah, there were two of them, too. Yeah. And the film is based on Ken Kesey's 1962 novel about a guy who is taken from a work farm over to a mental institution to be tested to see if he's faking it or not, to see if he's mentally ill also. And the film stars Jack Nicholson as that mental patient, and it's another aggressive, enthusiastic role for Nicholson. Some people, especially the people at United Artists who are trying to sell tickets to you, are putting out the theory that this may be Nicholson's fifth Academy Award nomination in 6 years.
It certainly is a case that it's often been a bridesmaid but never a bride for Nicholson. He's been nominated again and again. He makes that trek out to the Santa Monica Boulevard or the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion every year, and he never wins anything.
Okay, first thing, Ty, Jack Nicholson won the Oscar for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I was going to ask that because I love that book and that movie, so yeah. I'm glad. Yeah,
it's kind of a rough start. They sound very...
It's a lot of information, yeah, yes. And it's information that, like, why do I have to know exactly where Nicholson's going when he goes to the Oscars, and why do I have to hear that there were two cinematographers on it, stuff like that.
But the thing that's interesting about that, especially from Gene Siskel's point of view, Gene Siskel is always known as a bit more of a dry wit.
He's the British office, Roger Ebert, the U.S. office.
So even in this very first review, when Roger Ebert is like, oh, the crowd loved this movie, Gene Siskel's like, yeah, and they ruined my enjoyment of it. I wish they'd just shut up.
It's like, hey, man, people are going to watch movies the way they watch movies.
So pretty rough. And you read Sainer's book. It talks a lot about how Roger and Gene, they were not friends, okay? And they worked for competing newspapers. And so they would have to rehearse these things many, many times. And
oh, really? I didn't know that.
There was always this, there was for a while when we get into their later show, Gene Siskel's much taller than Roger Ebert. So when they built their set with them sitting in the two chairs, like the theater balcony, when they built it, Roger, they built like a cushion into his seat. So he was sitting, his head was the same level as Gene Siskel. Well, then Siskel was pissed off because why didn't he have a cushion? So they had to give him a cushion and then build one higher for Roger Ebert. And,
that's ridiculous.
Yeah. So they were not the best of friends. They were two professionals competing who both loved movies, loved writing about movies, loved talking to people about it. You watch this clip, you can find it on YouTube. Just type in Siskel and Ebert first show. You don't have to type in opening soon at a theater near you. But it's 1975, Ty. They got the big collars. Gene Siskel's got a killer mustache.
Big sideburns.
Yes, it is. Oh, nice. It is definitively 1975, but it did pretty well. And so every month they would have a new episode of opening soon at a theater near you. But obviously that's hard as hell to talk about. And since the show was a hit, they wanted to expand it to a weekly show. So they changed the name of it to Sneak Previews.
That's a better name than the original one.
I want to tell you, at this time, they're just telling you whether or not they think a movie's good or bad. There's no thumbs up, thumbs down. This is literally what it is. But Sneak Previews became a big hit. Sneak Previews was like almost on every PBS channel in the country. And they would do little things like they'd have Spot the Wonder Dog to do the Dog of the Week, some movie that they thought was terrible.
Oh, okay.
I want to actually read something that Roger Ebert said about one of these Dog of the Week movies, because this is going to give you an idea of the insight of Roger Ebert. So this was the movie Caligula. Now, do you know anything about the movie Caligula?
Apparently, it's very horny and very long. I've never seen it.
There's like Malcolm McDowell plays the Roman Emperor Caligula. Peter O'Toole's in it. Helen Mirren's in it. I know it was produced. I don't know if it was directed by Bob Guccione, who's the founder of Penthouse Magazine.
Okay.
This movie would have this very kind of serious movie in it with hardcore pornography shots. Now, it's not of those actors I just named.
No, but, sure.
But this is what Roger Ebert and their Dog of the Week said about Caligula. It's not good art, it's not good cinema, and it's not good porn.
They nailed all three parts right there. If that's what you're looking for, you're not going to get any of that. So they went for that review.
Yeah, they would do that. And then there's a couple of
Have you seen Caligula?
Yes.
Is it?
Oh, it's awful.
Bad? Okay, yeah. I've only ever heard about it.
Yeah, no, it's awful. It's not. Trust me, even if you're looking to be horny or whatever, don't watch Caligula.
Oh, okay. All right.
it's a bad, bad movie. What made this work for them, especially being on PBS, is they could say whatever they wanted about movies because you're not going to piss off a studio or you're not going to piss off an advertiser. And it worked out.
Public broadcasting. Yeah, you can do what you want.
And like I said, their show was kind of a big hit. Roger Ebert tended to be a little bit nicer to movies, but Gene Siskel seemed to like blockbusters more than Roger Ebert did. It worked well. These are two guys from Chicago, grew up in Chicago, and just loved movies. And they were very, like, they would say, this is your valuable time, okay?
Yeah.
We're telling you whether or not you should go see it. After a while, the person that owns Spot the Wonder Dog said, you guys should do the stinker of a week. I have a skunk who's been descented that you can use.
Oh, boy.
Problem is, skunks are very kind of shy creatures. So every time before they do the stinker of the week, they would tell, I think it was Gene Siskel, but they would say, you have to spin the skunk, and you have to grab the skunk and spin it around so people could
what?
See it. Yeah.
So weird.
You do anything for TV. Well,
I guess.
It was around this time, another Midwestern fellow who had a show on late at night in New York City by the name of David Letterman.
Greatest late night talk show host ever.
Now, I told you off mic, I was compiling like clips for this podcast, and I was seeing if there's anything that would have been interesting from the Letterman show. And there's a couple things. I didn't pull anything, but there's a guy who has done, it's six parts, and each part is like an hour and a half long of all Siskel and Ebert stuff on Letterman's show.
I didn't even realize, I love both, I love Siskel and Ebert, I love Letterman. I didn't realize they had a thing.
Oh, and I think together they were on Letterman 16 times. Wow. I think that was just his NBC show. They were on. When I talk about a little bit later, when I talk about Letterman and their celebrity, they would do a lot of skits on Letterman. Letterman had them on, a couple of these are all Midwest guys, and you could see they would, like, Roger and Gene really, when they were on Letterman, especially in those early days, they were trying to talk about film, they were trying to be serious, but they still had, they had a natural ability of just telling jokes. Like, they were good at it. They were really, really good at it. There was a rule at the time, this is, again, Letterman came on after Johnny Carson, that if Carson, the people that Carson had on could not be on Letterman. Mm-hmm. So that's why early David Letterman, you would get a lot of things like Andy Kaufman, or Letterman would get a lot of musicians when they were first starting out because he couldn't get Carson guests. And so he got Siskel and Ebert. Now, they were so popular that after a while, Carson started to want them on, but they would go on both shows. They were like literally the first guests that do each of the shows. But Letterman would have them on and talk about movies and make fun of Roger Ebert's weight. And they,
he got it so bad from people.
But he always took it.
He did. You're right.
He always took it. And there's a couple of good one-liners I'll bring up later. But you could tell, though, that they really cared about movies. And in this first Letterman interview, they talked about being on PBS and about how we don't have to worry about studios and we don't have to worry about sponsors and things like that. Well, the next time they were on Letterman, they had a new show. And what had happened is the Tribune Company, who Gene Siskel worked for, had approached them about creating a syndicated television show.
Okay.
Saying they'd make a lot more money. Now, syndicated television means advertisers.
Yeah.
So when they were on the second time and Letterman was like, wait, I thought you guys said you didn't want to do this. And they're like, no, money's better. So that is At the Movies, which went through in the time the show was called At the Movies. Then it was called Siskel and Ebert At the Movies. And then finally just called Siskel and Ebert.
Yep.
This is also where the thumbs up, thumbs down system started to come in. And again, this whole story, Reed Sainer's book about just the thumbs and how they came to that. Also, Siskel and Ebert. Not Ebert and Siskel.
Yeah, Siskel and Ebert sounds better.
That's what the producer said. But again, Roger Ebert is like, I've got a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, and that's true. But like, see, this is the thing, and it's always funny because Scott Aukerman makes a joke on Comedy Bag Bag all the time about where you are on a call sheet. That stuff. And again, I don't work in that industry. I don't know, but it doesn't matter. Like, if you came to me and said, hey, we're changing the name of our podcast from Lex Millennial Man to RD and Ty, I'd be like, okay. I wouldn't complain about it. It needs to be Ty and RD. So I don't understand why. I guess when you get to that level of fame, you get a big ego. Mm-hmm. And it seems like these two had ego already to begin with. So when you get to that level, I guess it's like, no, I have viewers. No, I want to be like, law firms do this all the time with their names too.
The legend is that it was decided on a coin flip. And then the agreement was after 2 years, they changed the name to Ebert and Siskel At the Movies.
It doesn't flow as well as Siskel and Ebert does. And he gets to be the last name said. Yeah. Like, that's the last thing we hear is Ebert.
Well, 2 years later, when they were shooting the opening again, and this is famous opening of them running through Chicago, trying to make their way to the movie theater, the Tribune Company said that they didn't want to pay for a new marquee, and the marquee said Siskel and Ebert, so that's why it's Siskel and Ebert. Now, I do think it's interesting. When you read Sainer's book or you hear anybody talk about him, they always refer to him, if they don't refer to him as Siskel and Ebert, they refer to him as Roger and Gene.
Okay.
So Roger is always brought up first. Roger Ebert is always brought up first. This is what we know as Siskel and Ebert. And I got a few clips I'm going to play you here because their film criticism was legendary. Oh, I'm sorry. Before I even get to that, after the Tribune Company, they ended up, or the Tribune Company, I believe, was still Sneak Previews, or I can't remember. My point is Disney approached them in like the mid-1980s and was willing to offer them a lot of money to come on over to Disney and do their syndicated show there, which it was basically with Disney till the show died with Roger Ebert, essentially. There's another Letterman when they're on there and he's like, well, it's a movie studio now. How are you going to review their movies? How are you going to review their movies if they're bad? And Roger Ebert said, I can't wait for Disney to make a bad movie so I can trash it. And you know, I'm not in their back pocket. Problem is, ever since they hired us, they only make good movies.
That's like, I mean, all credit to The Simpsons because they constantly make fun of Fox. So
now there's a couple of very famous review stories about Siskel and Ebert. One of which is when they did Full Metal Jacket, Gene Siskel gave it a thumbs up and Roger Ebert gave it a thumbs down. The very next movie they reviewed is a Benji movie that Roger Ebert gave a thumbs up and Gene Siskel lost his goddamn mind.
Well, Full Metal Jacket's a classic. I don't know of this Benji movie, but it's hilarious to me that Roger Ebert's like, oh, no, I can't give Full Metal Jacket its due, but this Benji movie, this is where it's at.
But these are, their disagreements are legendary. Another one is the Burt Reynolds comedy Cop and a Half.
God, I hated that movie when I was a kid.
That Roger Ebert gave a thumbs up and Gene Siskel is like, oh, Santa Claus coming early this year. In the book, they talk about a story about how the kid in Cop and a Half wrote Roger Ebert a letter saying, thank you for giving my movie a good review. And Roger Ebert was so proud, he's bringing it around the office for the at the movies. And he put it on the wall and Gene Siskel said, idiot, look at that handwriting. Who do you think wrote that? And it was Gene Siskel.
That's awesome.
And there's a lot of like pranks and stuff they pulled, but I've got a few clips here I want to play. And the first one is, this is a movie they both agreed on, but because one always had to get the, like, the movie's Jacob's Ladder with,
I've never seen that, all about it.
Yeah, what's his name, Nuke LaRouche, why can't I think of the actor's name?
Tim Robbins.
Yeah,
this LaLute.
LaLouche, thank you. I was thinking of Lyndon LaRouche, but
I was gonna say, I just watched Bull Durham for like the 50th time the other day. So,
but this is, I'm picking up at the end of the film clips part and Gene Siskel talking about this movie. And again, this is a movie they both liked, but I want you to hear the conversation they have.
I found the journey of Jacob Singer worth taking.
In other words, you wanted the ending to be more simple-minded.
I'd like the ending to be maybe less complicated than it is, because I think the story is fascinating.
Gene, I think the ending is transparently clear what it's trying to say. And I think I like this movie as much as you do, but I think I like it for what's there on the screen, whereas you seem to criticize the very strengths of the movie. This is a portrait of a paranoid schizophrenic.
Right.
He is living in a world in which he has no idea what is real and what isn't real.
Right.
At the end, he and we find out something that makes everything before fall into place, and that's the part you don't like.
The way it falls into place is what I don't like in the picture. I think that the picture is very strong in presenting the world. I think it was pretty easy to guess what was going on. I had no trouble guessing it. And I guess I thought that if they had made the explanation, there's some red herrings thrown in this piece that I thought it's just overflowing.
Well, the red herrings are thrown in by the character himself.
Right.
If you, and I don't want to give the plot away, but the fact is that everything in this movie comes out of his mind in one way or another.
Right.
And the fact is that at the end, I enjoyed the fact that I was being challenged to think and to retrospectively figure out what was going on during the entire movie. I don't want it to be simple. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be one of those canned Hollywood endings where everything is all tied up in a neat bow. The challenging thing about this movie is that it really takes you into this mental state and makes you occupy that state along with the character.
Yeah. And I don't know what you're so angry about, because I enjoyed this film very, very much.
But you...
So
Gene Siskel is much more chill about it.
Roger was pissed on that.
And they both liked it.
Yes.
That's the crazy thing.
So that is the crazy thing. They would argue about these things just to argue sometimes.
Uh-huh. It'd be like, the sky's blue. No, it's not. It's this shade of blue or whatever it is.
Well, there is another clip. Now, again, most of the time, it's their disagreements that are more legendary. Yeah. They're big, deep disagreements. And in the entire history of the show, only once ever did a critic ever change his review in the show. And that was for the John Travolta movie Broken Arrow.
I've never seen that. I know what that is.
Yeah, but Gene Siskel liked it. And then Roger said there's all these problems with it. And Roger Ebert said, everything you just said is why I said thumbs down. And then Gene Siskel said, you know what? You're right. I'm going to give it a thumbs down. And Roger Ebert was like, oh, look what happened. Now, mind you, Ty, Broken Arrow came out, I think, like 8 years after Cop and a Half.
Oh, okay.
At the end of the review, Gene Siskel says, now, Roger, I want you to change your review of Cop and a Half.
That's fantastic. Isn't Jack Black in Broken Arrow?
Oh, is he? He might be, I think.
I think he like gets blown up by something and then hit it.
So I'm going to do part of their review for the David Cronenberg film Crash.
So it's hilarious, because I remember when that other awful Crash movie came out, and you would always say, I would be like, oh, I'm going to go see Crash. You'd be like, the one where people get into car accidents and have sex. And I was always like, what?
Now, this is also a personal thing for me. When I talk about how Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel influenced me personally, I remember I was dating a girl at the time, and she was talking about this movie Crash and how it's the only movie she ever walked out of. And I said, well, you walked out of it because you didn't understand it, because you don't understand art.
What? What a butthead you are, man. You told a girl that you were dating that she didn't understand art?
Yeah.
What is the matter with you?
I am married to that girl today. So.
I need to talk to her about this now.
So I guarantee you what I said, and this was early on, but what I said had everything to do with what Roger Ebert said about Crash. So I'm going to play that for you.
Okay.
Directed by David Cronenberg, the adventurous Canadian filmmaker of Scanners and Dead Ringers fame. And my honest reaction is that the subject of Crash left me feeling empty, not even challenged in the am I hip enough to get it way. Crash has some beautiful bodies on view, but also some ugly ideas. And as I said, I think it really did leave me cold.
Well, of course, it was intended to leave you cold. I think I liked the movie a lot more than you did. I would like to make it clear that most people are probably going to hate it, be repelled by it, or walk out of it just as they did at the Cannes Film Festival.
Why is that?
Because it's too tough for them to take.
Oh, you mean really Roger?
Is. Yes, it is. It is.
Wait a second.
Sex involving wounds and blood and scabs and braces. A lot of people don't want to see it, don't want to have anything to do with it, don't want to get close to it.
I want to be clear. Do you think that that's my objection, the nature of my objection?
I felt that your objection was that you didn't really bring any sympathy to what he was trying to do, and I'll tell you what he was trying to do. He's trying to make a pornographic movie without pornography. He's taking the form of a pornographic movie without the function or the content. He's substituting car crashes for the usual erotic stuff in order to show the mechanism of human compulsion and obsession.
Okay, but wait a second.
And it's a fascinating study of the way the mind works in connection with images that we connect with sex.
Roger, it can't. I'm going to review the movie, and then I'll review your review. My objection. So,
the more I listen to these, the more I like side with Gene Siskel. Also, how pretentious did you have? I got to talk to your wife. I got to talk to my sister-in-law about this now.
Yeah, I say that one's for you, baby. But
isn't James Spader in that movie?
Yeah, James Spader and Holly Hunter.
I have an issue with David Cronenberg because when I was a kid, you're one of my older brothers. I have three older brothers. You guys used to make me watch The Fly, and that movie still freaks me out. So I never was able to get into Cronenberg. But it goes the same thing with I wrote about this movie Teton I saw a couple years ago. I don't like body horror movies.
Yeah,
those freak me out. So Roger Ebert talking about sex with wounds and scabs and stuff. I don't think I'm going to watch this version of Crash.
Yeah, I guarantee you my pretentiousness came from Roger Ebert's review of Crash. But I want to end this half, though, on where Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel were just at another level. And that's when they hated a movie.
Okay.
The visceral reaction they would take. Like, there was, I can't remember what movie it was, but I think Gallo was a director. Buffalo 66 or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the name. That's the movie where... What's her face?
Yeah. Chloe 70. Yeah. Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Look it up if you don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But Roger Ebert gave it a bad review. And
Vincent Gallo.
That's it. Yeah. And Vincent Gallo went out and said, Roger Ebert just looks like a fat South African slave trader. Why would I listen to him? And Roger Ebert wrote in his review saying, he is right. I am overweight, but I can lose weight. But Vincent Gallo will always be the director. Of so-and-so.
Get him. I love it.
Or when this is Roger Ebert, but for the movie North, Elijah Wood, Robert De Niro.
Oh,
and so
yeah.
His review for that movie was, I hated this movie.
Before we get to the second half, correct me if I'm wrong, but when Phil Hartman, may he rest in peace, one of the greatest comic minds of all time, when he was doing the skit on SNL and he said, when he was talking about Fools Rush In, he said you'd be a fool not to rush out. Was he trying to be
what's his name on CNN, the guy with the suspenders.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know who you're talking about, but
why can't I think of his name?
I can't think of his name either. You and I always make that joke all the time, but I didn't know if he was trying to be Roger Ebert or not, because the whole idea of I can lose weight, but you made this movie art. I hated it. I wonder when he sat down to write that, he's like, how many times can I put hated in this when I'm writing this review?
Larry King. That's who I was
thinking. Okay.
And before, I'm not going to talk about it, but the sneak preview show did go on after Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel left. And it had Jeffrey Lyons, Neil Gabler, Michael Medved, who's a right-wing nut job. But it was never Siskel and Ebert. And it's because of them. Here's the thing that they, both of them, talked a lot about. You are giving up time to go to the movies.
Uh-huh.
You are deciding to spend your time paying money to watch somebody's creation. And they were very, very protective of that. And that's what they would say their whole show was about, is we're going to tell you whether or not it's worth you spending your time. If we think it's worth you spending your time. And they go a lot into that's the most valuable thing you have is time.
Uh-huh.
So the movie She's All That, I think it was the name of the title. Tony Danza. Or She's Out of Control. Sorry, no, I'm thinking the wrong one.
Okay.
It's a movie called She's Out of Control. It came out in the early 90s. And
I don't know that one.
This is a bit more of a legendary review on what Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel say, because I'm going to tell you up front, Ty, they did not like this movie.
Obviously.
And they decided I'm going to give you their kind of part of their review here. Now, mind you, they had also, just before this movie, they had reviewed the movie Say Anything, that they both really liked a lot.
I've never seen that movie. I heard it's really good, though. Yeah.
So this is what they had to say about She's Out of Control.
I think She's Out of Control is really a depressing experience. It is neither lifelike nor an effective fantasy. That scene you just saw tries to rip off 10, but it isn't 10. Rather, this film exists in the strange netherworld, I think, of what Hollywood considers entertainment, but is really a sinkhole of tawdry values. The film is photographed ineptly in tight TV shots, and when I saw She's Out of Control, I became so depressed I actually thought about quitting my job as a film critic, feeling as though the movies had abandoned me, because what I was seeing there really wasn't a movie. It was some sort of strange concoction of really this someone who didn't understand what movies were all about. Fortunately, however, I would see the movie Say Anything later in the same day, and all is right with the world. I'm still on the job.
You know, people probably think you're joking when you said thinking of quitting your job. But I know what you felt, because I sat there and I thought, life is precious, life is short, and the idiots who made this film are taking 2 hours of my life and robbing it from me in order to give me less than nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, a movie like this is a crime, because what it does is it robs life from people by requiring them to spend 2 hours having such a terrible experience happen to them. Now,
yeah.
I love it. You know, and it's so fascinating, because I would love to, if we could like bring them back or something and have them, because movies are so much longer now, and they're right about the time. Like, I thought for a week after Dune 2 came out, and I loved the first Dune. I'm not David Lynch fan like you are, but I love the first Dune that Denis Villeneuve, I don't know how to say his name.
Villeneuve, yeah.
But I love that movie. I watched that at home. So I thought for a week, do I really want to go to the theaters? Do I want to spend over 3 hours in there to watch this movie? I'm glad I did, but I thought about it. So I appreciate that when they don't like something and they really don't like it, they're telling you, don't waste your time. Don't go to the theaters to watch this. So I love that fact that was forefront, especially for Roger Ebert. That was forefront.
Well, for a movie like She's Out of Control, the only reason anybody remembers it is because of what Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert said about it.
I never heard of it before. So.
But there's a particular movie we're going to break and talk about when they like a movie. And I mean, really like a movie. They absolutely, in the case I'm going to give you, made people go watch a movie and probably changed the world of cinema.
Cool.
Hello all, this is RD, and I want to talk to you about something called Public Forum Productions. Now, you've heard me reference it, and if you are a person that looks deep, deep into the notes, you'll see that Public Forum Productions actually is the producer of The Ex-Millennial Man, the podcast you're listening to right now. Well, 2024 is going to be a big year at PSP, and I want to invite you to become part of that. Go to publicforumproductions.com and you can see the stable of shows we have. It's a network, kind of like, think of it like Netflix, and Ex-Millennial Man is one of the shows. We also have High Heels and Politics, First Watch, Rewatch, and coming in 2024, we already have two shows actively in production right now. One is called Where Did You Go to High School? I know a lot of our listeners are in the St. Louis area and are in Southwest Ohio, because you guys know Ty or myself. And that's the biggest question. Where did you go to high school? For the record, I went to Lafayette High School in St. Louis, in the St. Louis area. But it's a big, big deal. My son here in Southwest Ohio goes to a really well-known high school, and it kind of identifies who we are. Also, the other show we have working on is called Satan Remembers. It's a history of the 1980s Satanic Panic. That is where we're done planning it. We're getting ready to record, do interviews and stuff. And I want to really make this good. It's going to be a series that's going to go through what happened in the early 1980s and kind of the moral panic and the accusations of Satanism that destroyed a lot of people's lives, destroyed a lot of people's businesses, and all were completely unfounded. And I want to do that now, because a lot of what we saw 40 years ago, we're seeing today. So I think it's very important. Again, go to publicforumproductions.com, reach out to me, and if you want to be a guest, if you want to do your own podcast, if you have information that can help us with these things, because like I said, those two shows are currently in production, but we have a few that are in pre-production, and I'm going to really need some voices for there. So again, publicforumproductions.com, and let's get back to the conversation.
Okay, Ty, I ended with the most brutal review you could give a movie ever.
Yeah.
Something that Siskel and Ebert did, though, and again, it trained an entire generation, my generation, your generation to an extent, about other movies that are out there. They really wanted to cover foreign movies and like documentaries. And they were really, really big on that. And I believe it was in, God, I want to say it was late 70s or something. The documentarian Errol Morris, his first movie is about two pet cemeteries in like the LA area called Gates of Heaven. And it was only showing in one theater in New York. This theater was basically, it was going to show there for 30 days and they were counting down to it was gone because nobody was seeing it. But Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel talked about it a lot, kept telling people, go see this movie. And all of a sudden, it started to show more and more, and it got a bigger release. And Errol Morris has said, those guys, they helped my career. Years later, 1994, Chicago documentary, actually, he's not from Chicago, but a Chicago documentarian named Steve James.
Had spent
the last 5 years following two African-American kids in Chicago in their basketball careers.
Greatest basketball movie ever made. It's not even close.
So he was able to go to get a screening at Sundance, and they put it at 10:30 at night on like a Tuesday.
That movie's 2.5 hours.
3 hours.
Three. Okay.
Yeah. So he decided to give an advance copy to Siskel and Ebert to look at it, and things that they liked stories like what they call true American stories. They like documentary. They like documentaries, and they love, and I mean love, Chicago.
Oh yeah.
So for the first time ever, before a movie had been on the circuit, the festival circuit, they did a review of Hoop Dreams before its show at Sundance.
Sundance, that makes me so happy.
And I'm going to play for you what they said.
I'll tell you how good Hoop Dreams is. I couldn't wait until the end of the picture to see what ultimately happens to these kids. We learned that in a series of titles flashed across the screen, but I'm hoping for updates as their lives progress. In a few years, I'd like to see another documentary on them. A documentary on chasing the NBA dream and the often harsh realities along the way. Hoop Dreams will play this week and next at the Sundance Film Festival. I'm sure it's going to be received well there. So let me add my congratulations to those that are going to be earned by director Steve James and photographer Peter Gilbert. They have made a special film.
Boy, they sure have. This is one of the best films about American life that I have ever seen. And I was, for 3 hours, I was just totally absorbed by the story of these two families, really. It's not just the kids, but their families. And you know, we get so many images in the movies of black inner city characters with guns and drugs and gangs. Here are families that are struggling to make it. You don't hear all the four-letter words or the 12-letter words. You see dinner on the table at night. You see kids getting up before dawn in order to take an hour and a half commute to go to school. You see them trying to study, and then at the same time, you see the way their basketball skills are really manipulated, even at the high school level, before they ever get to college, by people who want to make use of those skills. Right. It's a movie that just raises so many questions and has so many insights.
Nobody had seen, or very few people had seen this movie.
It's hands down the best movie about basketball that there is out there. I will argue that to the high hills. Much like they said, I wanted to know what happened. They did make a quote-unquote sequel to it. It wasn't great. It didn't have the heart that Hoop Dreams had. And that's the thing about Hoop Dreams is, you know, we have so many reality shows, and they're all scripted. Hoop Dreams is real. This is real life. You see what these kids go through. There's nothing manipulating besides the people in it.
It's not a false narrative. It's five years. It's high school and the first year of college for these kids. Yeah.
Arthur Agee, I felt so bad for him because the coach at the school that I cannot think of the other boy's name, the other gentleman's name that is in the movie. But Arthur Agee goes to the school that Isaiah Thomas went to. And that varsity basketball coach, he was the villain in this movie to me. Arthur Agee goes on and, just like they said, manipulate their skills. He went to play at a public school out there. Thrived, ended up going to the JUCO route, actually to a school in Missouri called Mineral Area Community College. And the other, cannot think of his name, is driving me nuts.
William Gates.
I was going to say Dennis Gates. So I was like, that's not right. William Gates, all the skill in the world. Both parents are involved in his life, everything like that. Ends up playing at Marquette, but it doesn't work out for him like so many other people. But just like they said, there's a scene Arthur Agee's family, his mom can't afford to pay the light bill. Lights go out. They're walking around the house with lamps. He has a friend come over and they're having cut up hot dogs on white bread with mustard to show you, like, this is how poor we are. This is how much we have to struggle to make it through the day. His dad's in and out of his life. And then William Gates, he gets his girlfriend pregnant in high school. He loses the love for basketball. He hurts his knee. Like, it is such a good movie. And the fact that these two, they're influencers is what you'd call them today. They influenced me for sure in my taste for movies. The fact that they love this movie so much that they talked about it so much. It was, I wanted to see it because of what they said about it. And then I fell in love with the movie the moment I saw it. It's the greatest basketball movie, quite possibly the greatest sports movie ever made.
Well, Steve James said his 10:30 Tuesday night Sundance showing was packed. Yeah.
Nice. Good.
That's after good. After Siskel and Ebert talked about this, and they ended up talking about Hoop Dreams two more times during the course of the year. They reviewed it again when it hit the theaters, and this movie was the highest grossing documentary at the time. It made a lot of money. And then they talked about it a third time when the Academy Awards did not nominate it for Best Documentary.
Which is nuts. That's crazy.
They went on the Letterman show and talked about it. They were champions of this movie. And even to the point of when Roger Ebert did Gene Siskel Pass, which we'll get to, spoiler alert, but when he did the greatest movies of the 1990s, his co-host was Martin Scorsese.
Wow.
Roger Ebert picked Hoop Dreams as the greatest film of the 1990s.
It's a perfect movie.
I mean,
it's the perfect documentary. It's a perfect movie.
And they didn't use their power to make a Marvel movie or Titanic or something, all this money. They did it for Hoop Dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And as Steve James has said, I owe those two men my career.
The guy made a classic movie, and the fact that these two, it didn't hurt that the movie took place in Chicago, but like the fact that these two Chicagoans fell in love with it, who have so much pull across the whole United States, maybe even the world for all I know. This is why I like Siskel and Ebert, why I watch Siskel and Ebert, to find out about stuff. You know, as a kid, I love basketball. It's like, oh, there's a movie about kids going through high school. Let me watch this movie. Oh, it's great.
Outside of their movie review show, Siskel and Ebert, their thumbs became just a huge part of pop culture in the 80s.
It was all over. If they liked a movie, that's what it said at the top of the poster. Two thumbs up.
And they would go, like I said, they were on Letterman a bunch. They were on Carson. They were on Leno. They were on all of the talk shows. But it was kind of this weird relationship they had with Dave Letterman. And again, I think it's because they're all Midwestern guys.
Totally.
Well, early in Dave's show, like early 80s, one time for Gene and Roger to settle a review that they were split on, Letterman had him shoot free throws.
That's awesome.
But when he moved to CBS, he actually incorporated Siskel and Ebert a lot in like skits. There would be, I can't remember the two guys' names, but there are these two South Asian fellows that owned a little shop right near Letterman's.
I know who you're talking about.
And they were always very deadpan all the time. Uh-huh. And there was one time Letterman sent him across the country as like a joke. And he's like, I wonder who's minding the shop now. And they go down there and it's Siskel and Ebert. And they would do like, every now and then they would have them on as guests, but they would always have these little skits and stuff like that. And one of my favorite, I encourage people to go find it, is it's more of a visual thing than an audio thing. But he's like, hey, I'm going to take my friend Siskel and Ebert out to a neighborhood in New Jersey and just knock on people's doors. And you see him, they knock on this old lady's door and Roger Ebert's like, I can play the William Tell Overture just with my fingers. You want to see? And he's like hitting the lady's door and she looks not thrilled. and then he's like, hey, we need something to do. Do you have anything we could help you around the house with? And she's like, you could clean my gutters. And you see Roger Ebert taking leaves out and Gene Siskel putting them in a bag. At the end of it, there's this old man and Letterman's like, oh, I see you have a hoop. How about we play 2-on-2? Siskel and Ebert against you and I. And you see
rules.
Siskel passes the ball over to Ebert, he puts a layup in, and then Siskel yells, Chicago, 2 up.
That is awesome.
Now, when it comes to basketball, Gene Siskel, like I said, worked for the Tribune Company. And when they ended up leaving for Disney, they tried to screw with his position at the paper, where Roger Ebert publicly came out to defend Gene Siskel. But Gene Siskel did a lot of work for WGN, the Tribune. During the Bulls runs of the playoffs, Gene Siskel would do all the locker room reports.
Oh, nice.
And so he became good buddies with all those Bulls players. Huge, huge basketball fan. Just loved basketball as much as he had season tickets, but as much as he loved movies, and he would be known for doing that. Well, in May, I think it was May of 1998, I believe. Yeah. Siskel and Ebert were doing a Leno's show. And on the way there, Gene Siskel talked about how much his head hurt. He just told Roger, say whatever you want, and I'll just agree with you. We just got to get through this. And even Jay Leno saw him and said, why don't you go home? And he's like, no, I'm going to do this. Well, the producers are like, Gene, you need to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
This was on May 6th. And he said, no, I've got tickets to the Bulls Charlotte Hornets playoff game tonight, which the Bulls lost. And
oh, man.
So on May 8th, he went to the doctor and they told him he had terminal brain cancer.
Jesus.
Yeah. So Gene Siskel had surgery, didn't want anybody to know, including Roger Ebert. Didn't want anybody to know what was going on. He had surgery, and all they said was he had some surgery. He'll be out for a little while rehabilitating. Now, during that time, he would call in and do the reviews of Siskel and Ebert.
After having brain surgery?
Mm-hmm. And also, knowing it's terminal.
Yeah, yeah.
He had three children. He had two daughters and a young son at the time. And there's a very prophetic thing like a year before where he and Roger Ebert got some kind of award, and he's telling his daughters that if I'm not here, I want you to know that I want you to go out and do what you love. I found a job I love, da-da-da, all this stuff. But when he came back, I remember this very well. He didn't look good.
Yeah.
They did another Letterman appearance. I think it was in September. And you could tell his speech is slower and he just doesn't look good. They did a show, their show in, I believe it was like early February, where they were reviewing some movies. You look at Gene Siskel and just doesn't look right. Okay. Sure. This is February of 1999. The year before, they always do their year end list. And his best movie of the year was Babe, Pig in the City. Because of how
you love that movie.
Oh, yeah, how inventive it was and all this other
stuff.
I love
that movie, too.
He hated the movie Patch Adams because he said, I've been to a lot of doctors this last year, and if I ever saw a doctor like that, I would just leave the hospital.
Yep.
But this February episode, which, again, he didn't look good, but at the very end of it, he's like, I want to make a correction. And he said something the week before, and he made a correction. And then it came out on February 3rd. They said, he's going to take a leave of absence for the rest of Roger Ebert. We'll have a rotating group of people, but he's going to use this to get better. Roger Ebert's wife, who he didn't marry till he was like 50, Chaz. Mm-hmm. Also, kind of a weird side note, Roger Ebert dated Oprah Winfrey.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And convinced Oprah, told her, you need to syndicate your show.
Oh, wow.
But his wife, Chaz, even says in Singer's book that, okay, this was February 3rd. He came home and he was happy. He's like, Gene's going to get better. We're going to come back. We're going to do the show. It's all going to be awesome. They get called about a week later and say, you need to come. Gene's very, very sick. So they made plans to go see him on a Monday. It was February 22nd. Gene Siskel died February 20th.
Oh, man.
Roger Ebert did not even know how sick
That's
he
crazy.
Was. And I'm going to play near the end of this a tribute that Roger Ebert did the very next week. He shows up at the movies in a black suit and said, this episode is a tribute to Gene Siskel. And just did a remembrance of him. And then Roger Ebert showed up at Letterman about 6 months later. And you could tell he and Letterman both were on the verge of tears.
Sure. Absolutely.
Just talking about it. But he did. The show did go on. He did a rotating, like a lot of famous critics would come on and do the movies. And whenever they could not find somebody, they would have the basically Roger's understudy, Richard Roper, come in and do the reviews.
Oh, yeah. Ebert and Roper. That's when he got his name in the front.
Yes. So they did so well. They wanted to go on. They changed the show. Now Roger Ebert gets top billing or first billing, but they do Ebert and Roper. And they did that show for like 7 years. But like Homer would say, Roger Ebert's kick-ass sidekick, Richard Roper. The show never worked because, and even Richard Roper says in the book, he grew up watching Siskel and Ebert.
Uh-huh.
So he admired them.
I still watched it when that was on, too, but I feel like Richard Roper was almost, I can't disagree with this guy because he's essentially my boss. So they agreed on it. It didn't have the same oomph and the same, like, ooh, what's going to happen next that Siskel and Ebert had.
Well, almost 3 years to the day, I think it was 3 years and one day after Gene Siskel died, Roger Ebert had some pain in his jaw, went to the doctor, and they found cancer.
Yep.
Over the course of nearly 7 years, Roger Ebert went through a lot of surgeries.
Oh, yeah.
And whereas Gene Siskel was very private about his health, Roger Ebert was not. He was very public.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He wanted people to see him in public with his half his jaw missing. They ended up, because he had said so many words, there was a computer program made where he would type what he was saying into the computer and it would speak back.
Mm-hmm.
Much like what like Stephen Hawking had.
Yeah.
But his mind was still there. He was still reviewing movies. He was mm-hmm. still doing it, but he just couldn't be, he couldn't speak anymore. He couldn't eat anymore. He couldn't be on set. So the Richard Roper ended up taking it with a rotating a group of hosts. The last First Watch rewatch I did was the Marie Antoinette movie, and the review is from A.O. Scott and Richard Roper.
Okay.
But the Buena Vista Television Disney had some issues with Richard Roper. He knew the writing was on the wall, and he left. And then the show went back to At the Movies, and they had, there was like, Ben Lyons and Steve Mankiewicz or something did it for a year. Everybody hated them.
Yeah, they weren't great.
No, Ben Lyons was just a person that would kiss everybody's butt. And then it went with a Michael Richards, or not Michael Richards. Who am I thinking?
I was going to say Kramer.
No. Michael Phillips. Sorry, Michael Phillips, who was another Chicago guy. He and A.O. Scott, they did it for about a year. And finally, Disney is like, the internet's coming around. You have IMDb, you have Rotten Tomatoes. This kind of idea of film criticism just isn't there anymore. The show was canceled. Roger Ebert and his wife, Chaz, they decided they were going to self-fund it. They got the old set from the old show that was on PBS. They went back to the PBS station and they had Roger Ebert presents At the Movies. And he found for the first time, he found a woman to be the lead, one of the lead reviewers in Christy Lemire. And
oh,
he
found
this young blogger that he really, really liked named Ignati Vishnevsky.
That guy.
What are your memories?
His favorite, I remember watching that show and thinking, man, this guy's a pretentious butthead. Like, I was so upset with him and annoyed. And his favorite movie one year, I kid you not, was a movie called Film Socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And I always just thought, you know, this guy is, he's a hipster. That's mm-hmm. what Ignati, he's a hipster. I think he writes for the AV Club now, or maybe he did for a while. I don't know where he is exactly, but he's the type of guy you go to, like, if you want to, I watch the cool stuff that you guys don't know about. I see Crash, David Cronenberg's Crash, and I get it. It's essentially what you said to your ex-wife, your ex-girlfriend, who's now your wife.
She's still my girlfriend. And I do have to say, because she's going to yell at me, I've never seen Cronenberg's Crash, so I was even more douchey than
Well, and like, and I'll bring up Scott Aukerman again. He always talks about his wife. He calls her his ex-girlfriend, whom he married because he broke up with her and then proposed to her. It's a whole bit if you listen to Comedy Bang Bang. But no, Ignati is, he's the hipster doofus of all this stuff. It's like, he's the type of guy who, when I started writing for the website, you called my reviews clothes and fedoras as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
He would call it that seriously.
Oh,
he's the guy who wears scarves to the movie theater, and he's the guy who has 10 jackets on. And I'm going to talk. He calls movies films. That's what I think of when I think of him.
Well,
Christy Lemire, way better.
Yeah. So
way better.
Roger Ebert, who always knew, he and Gene Siskel would always talk about technology. They would talk about DVDs, video cassettes, laser discs. They always talk about how technology was affecting movies, but not dismissing him. Ebert early on created RogerEbert.com. Before he passed, he selected a group of reviewers, and it is still one of the best movie review sites out there.
I look at it on IMDb all the time.
Christy Lemure is one of those reviewers. So he handpicked her to do that. But a little bit about Christy and Ignati is they did an episode where they talked about the movies that made them critics, movies they love. And Christy Lemure does this 5-minute thing on the movie The Breakfast Club. Okay.
Great.
She's around my age. Ignati, who is at the time like half my age.
Yeah.
His movie was some D.W. Griffith 1912 movie that nobody's ever heard of.
That's what I'm saying. He's younger than I am, and he's talking about a movie probably from the silent era that made him a critic. Dude, you watch Hot Rod just like I do. Mm-hmm. So don't act like you're better than me.
That's all right. No, and this podcast is going to go a little bit longer because this is this is a topic that is very important to me. And I thought about this. I've been toying around with the fact of you and I doing a greatest, what we think the best television shows of all time are.
Mm-hmm.
And I have at the top of my list, I have the rebooted Battlestar Galactica, the Star Wars Clone Wars, and Halt and Catch Fire. Those are three TV shows that I'm like, I've watched more than once. I still think they're great, all this other stuff. But Ty, the truth is, the best television show of my lifetime is Siskel and Ebert.
The Simpsons is what
Right. But for me, again, the show affected me in very negative ways with the way I talked to my old girlfriend. But it affected me in very positive ways that I discovered not just movies like Hoop Dreams or Gates of Heaven, but that I genuinely loved them. I didn't go watch the movie Babe until they told me to go watch it.
Totally. No, you bring up a good point, too. Again, it's a running joke in our family that I've learned more from The Simpsons than I did in school. I wouldn't know about movies if it weren't for Siskel and Ebert. You would always say stuff to me about, oh, these guys recommended this, and because I respect your taste in movies, okay, I listen to that. But when you and I, it wasn't until you and I lived together when I like started to watch that show and really got into that show and followed it to when after Gene Siskel passed away, I followed it to Ebert and Roper. And when Roper took over, I watched that. And then I really got into it when it was Ignati and Christy Lemire. Like I was, because I was really going to movies at that time. So this is definitely a property that stayed with me forever. And I think it's probably the greatest criticism show that's ever existed.
When you talk about its legacy and what made Roger and Gene so great is they were, first off, they were freaking professionals.
Oh, yeah.
And they didn't care about hurting the other one's feelings. I mean, I played two clips where basically Roger Ebert is telling Gene Siskel he knows nothing about art. But then you would see him on Letterman. And yeah, they'd always make fat jokes at Ebert's expense. And there was one time where Letterman made they weren't even guests. He made some fat joke about Roger Ebert. And then he said, that's the last joke I'm ever going to do. I'm going to retire it because Roger Ebert's losing weight. And Roger Ebert came out and got the cue card and they're playing music. And then and Roger Ebert looked at Dave Letterman and says, thank you, you son of a bitch. And walked off stage.
I love it.
And there was another time when Gene Siskel made like a fat joke on Letterman. And Roger Ebert is like, hey, I'm sitting here losing weight. Pretty soon they're going to be like not the bald one and the fat one, but the bald one and the good looking one. And Gene Siskel says, yeah, and they'll be talking about the same person. And so they were so good together that made it work so, so great. And you think about it, again, you have Rotten Tomatoes, you have all of this stuff that there's not really these types of shows anymore, but there are. This is what First Take is. This is what Pardon the Interruption is. This is two experts, I would say more Pardon the Interruption, because I think they're really experts. First Take
is full of,
yeah,
I'm talking louder than you type people. Yeah.
And for good or bad, there is, I think Michael Wilbon and Tony Kornheiser are the Siskel and Ebert of
100%.
But to close up the story here, Ty, Roger Ebert was very, very sick. He still worked. He worked all the time. And he ended up writing a memoir called Life Itself. And he contacted Steve James, Steve James contacted him to license it to make a movie about Roger Ebert.
Yep.
This is at the time he was, again, going through a lot of health things. And this movie is incredible. This is a movie about Roger Ebert's life. But you see him as he's going to the hospital. He's disfigured. He can't eat. You see him and his wife arguing about just the dumbest things ever. You see the love, but the pain in Chaz Ebert's eyes of what's going on. And during the filming of this, Roger Ebert had to go in for a surgery or something. And he wrote on his website that he's going to take what he called a leave of presence. He's still going to be there, but he's going to come back from the public eye.
Okay.
This was on August 2nd. He passed away on August 4th.
Man, I guess it's really true that when you know you're going to go, you're done. Yeah.
The last thing Roger Ebert ever wrote was this blog about his leave of presence and everything. And the very last line out of billions of words he wrote, the very last thing he wrote is, I'll see you at the movies.
Oh, man, that's perfect. I mean, that's like the perfect way for him to go out.
To go back in time a little bit, because again, a lot of this, it's weird to me. People are going to make fun of me. I'm getting teary in my eyes. When I read Sainer's book, the last two chapters, I had to stop at times because of how much I remembered this and how much a part of my life these two guys were who have been gone for well over a decade.
Again, there are four of us growing up, and they were most important to you by a wide margin in our house.
Like any kind of tribute or anything I can say, what they meant to me or stuff like that, Roger Ebert already said. The episode they did, Remembering Gene Siskel. And he closed it out, and I want to play this. He closed out with these remarks.
Whenever he interviewed someone for his newspaper or for television, Gene Siskel always liked to end with the same final question. What do you know for sure? Okay, Gene, what do I know for sure about you? Well, you were one of the smartest, funniest, quickest men I've ever known, and one of the best reporters. It was almost impossible to tell you anything that you didn't already know. Your friend Bob Green wrote in the paper that sometimes you seemed like a wise old man, and on other days you seemed about 11 years old. And I know for sure that seeing a truly great movie made you so happy that you'd tell me a week later your spirits were still high. I know you were a man who loved your family deeply and fiercely, your wife Marlene, your teenage daughters, and your young son.
That says Perfect. Who those two men were.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's trying to find the right words for it, but it's their influence on people like me and my love for movies, my love for different kind of movies. The fact that somebody like you, especially the age you were at, to see these two old rich white men championing a movie like Hoop Dreams.
Totally. Changed my perspective on movies.
I mean,
I'd never seen a documentary until they talked about Hoop Dreams, and then I saw Hoop Dreams.
I mean, Roger Ebert gave a bad review to the movie Blue Velvet, and Gene Siskel was upset with him about it for years. Even on one of these legendary Letterman performances, he and Letterman were both kind of going after Ebert about it. Gene Siskel said, you had some kind of like weird reaction to that movie. He's like, yeah, the weird reaction I had is because it was a bad movie.
Blue Velvet's a weird movie, yeah. That's for sure.
Gene Siskel didn't like Silence of the Lambs.
That movie creeps me out, dude.
I mean, so these were guys that were not, even though when they were run by Disney and stuff like that. When Gene Siskel died, the outpouring of grief was huge. He was 53. He was far too young.
Jesus, that's so young.
When Roger Ebert died, who again, 70, not that old, but we'd seen his sickness for years, and we knew what was coming. We knew what was happening. But the outpouring of grief was the same. And even Martin Scorsese was like, yeah, these guys are film critics, or Roger Ebert is film critic, but he loved movies, and that's what made him my friend. Yeah. And I love movies. And it's because of those two.
Everybody's a critic now. Everybody's got a take on something. These two guys were respected critics. If they were going to talk about a movie, if they were going to spend their time talking about it, the people who made that movie would listen, just like you and I would listen to it, or you would listen to it when you first started watching the show. I'm sure if we talked to our mom and dad about it, they would say that they listened to what Siskel and Ebert said, because they carry more weight than a guy like A.O. Scott or Christy Lemire. It's just, it's not the same as Gene Siskel and Ebert. Saying what when I did read reviews, they were the first two reviews I would read before I would go see a movie, more so Roger Ebert, because you said Gene Siskel died in like 98 or something.
99. Is that February 99?
So, I was 16 going on 17 years old. I didn't really pay much attention, but Roger Ebert, I definitely read a lot more. So these guys they were critics that cared about the craft, cared about what they were doing. They weren't just going to write something to get clicks or to get people to buy the magazine or the newspaper. What they were saying is how they truly actually felt about what they watched.
Well, Ty, that was a heavy one for me to do, but a fun one at the same time.
People listening, like, you adored these two and you watched this show constantly. Like, I would have never known about it if it weren't for you.
One day we'll talk about, like, what celebrity deaths probably hit us the most. And to me, it's a very short list. It's Prince, Gene Siskel.
Chadwick Boseman.
That's
for me.
Yes.
Yeah. It's for me.
Mark Paul Gosselaar and Tone Loc. Didn't they die the same day? Wasn't that some weird?
They're both still alive.
Yes. I know. But just such a weird one. But okay, Ty. Well, when they call us and they say, that's it, we're inspired. You two jabronis are going to start doing at the movies. Where can they find you?
We may be brothers, but we definitely have the animosity. We've gotten some heated arguments. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram, TYKULAK, all lowercase. More importantly, come read my stuff on SeedSing.com. I'm not the writer that those two were, but I write movie reviews a lot on the website. So check it out, SeedSing, SEEDSING.com. You can find me on a couple episodes of Chucklehead Chat, hosted by our buddy Glenn Adams, wherever you get podcasts. Listen to check out our Patreon. Listen to First Watch Rewatch. I'm getting really excited to watch the next movie for that you told me about during our last record. So check all that stuff out on our Patreon. most importantly, listen to the X-Millennial, man. Rate, review us, tell your friends about us. And as always, Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, repeat all that. Seed saying X-Millennial, man. I need to go dig up what they said about the movie Heavy Metal because I'm really excited.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, look that one up yet. But yeah, again, like I said, this one's a little bit longer, but I wanted, especially at the end, talk about what influence they not just had on me, but had on, I think, society in general. And so the next time you see Skip Bayless say something stupid, blame Roger and Gene.
No, do not put him in the same sentence as those two.
All right, Ty. Well, with all that being said, we thank you for your ears. Anything else that you may use to listen to the X-Millennial Man podcast? We're here every Saturday for free, wherever you find your fine podcasts and shows. And with that, Ty, I guess I'll say the virtual balcony is closed.
Sounds good. Stay fresh, cheese bags.
The X-Millennial Man podcast is a production of SeedSane.com, fully owned by R.D. Kulik & Associates, LLC. Producers Ty Kulik and Ryan Kulik, adequately engineered by Ryan Kulik.